There I am, minding my own business, quite literally doing my business on a toilet, when all of a sudden the bathroom turns into a disco party hall. The room is huge now, and there are people everywhere dancing about under the disco ball, and there I am with my pants around my ankles just trying to get them to desperately leave. Then John Oliver comes in, who is my boyfriend, and he's trying to console me with pizza, but I keep trying to tell him that I'm deathly allergic to cheese, apparently. But when I try to get the words out, I start choking. There's gum in my mouth, and now I have braces, and I'm pulling it out of the brackets, and it just keeps coming and coming and coming. I jolt awake. I'm having some weird dreams. But what do they mean? And what is a dream anyway? Can we train our brains to control them? Or even steal them out of other people's heads? You're about to find out, because you're listening to Mimi and the Brain. Oh, window, found it, crawling in.
Would you mind telling me whose brain I did put in? Abby someone. Abby who? Abby Noble.
That's 21 gigawatts!
Tell us about yourself.
A tiny clump of cells in my cerebellum had ruptured.
That doesn't make sense.
What?
Yeah, I know, nothing is real.
This is Westworld. We're all robots. Great.
I want the truth!
Guys, let's get this podcast started.
Today's episode brings us into the fascinating world of the unconscious. Dreams, the obscure and often impossible things we think up when we're catching some Z's. Today, I sat with Dr. Moran Cerf, just about the most interesting person I've ever met. He's a professor of neuroscience and business at the Kellogg School of Management, where he works with patients undergoing brain surgery to study behavior, emotion, decision-making, and dreams using electrodes implanted in their brains. In a former life, Dr. C was a computer hacker who hacked into big banks and companies to help them up their security software. In his non-existent free time, Cerf is a regular Moth Grand Slam storytelling champion and also teaches screenwriting classes, consulting writers on how to incorporate science in their Hollywood blockbusters. You've seen his work just about everywhere, BBC, NPR, Time, Bloomberg, the list goes on. Oh, and to top it all off, he's got a lovely French accent. Ooh la la. So anyway, let's just cut to the chase. Hello, welcome to the show, Maha Cerf. Did I say it right?
Almost. Very well.
Oh, me. welcome. Thank you so much for being on Mimi and the Brain today.
Thank you.
You are a fascinating, fascinating human being, and I'm so excited to chat with you about dreams and all kinds of things today. Wanted to kind of start with your upbringing a little bit, as I had attempted a very poor French pronunciation of your accent. You were born in Paris. Is this correct?
It is correct.
Okay. And raised in Israel.
Correct as well.
Okay. So what was it like, experiencing science education where you grew up? You know, did you have an early curiosity of the brain at a young age?
So I didn't call it brain science when I was a kid. I didn't know what this was, and I didn't think I'm going to be an academic. But the same questions I'm interested in right now are the ones I was interested in as a kid. So I clearly remember those, bonfires that we had, me and my friends, and we kind of spoke about profound questions about life, kind of like, how did the world begin and what happens before? What happens when you go to sleep? Like, do you disappear or do you still exist? What is quantum physics? Is Goofy a dog or a horse? All of those questions that kind of, come to life.
Yes, the real questions. No, I love that. So you're really quite the Renaissance man, which I feel, kindred spirits, because I'm a former teacher turned comedian, podcaster person, and you have lived many lives as well. Furniture designer, pilot, computer hacker, filmmaker, and now a world-renowned neuroscientist. So could you maybe give us like a little smattering, a little sampling of some of those lives? You know, your resume is basically a novel, so...
So first of all, I'm being told often by my mom mostly that this is not a good thing, that you should have one thing that you do, and like that if you're in many places, there's the argument in our family whether a jack of all trades is a good thing or a bad thing. I read an article recently that says a jack of all trades, master of none, but better than master of one. So it's good to have at least a few things because you're better than the one that has only one perfect thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to cling to that statement. I think that in many ways, like most people's life stories, it's a random chain of events that you then, in kind of going back, you tell a story as if it was planned. You know, I'm involved right now with admissions to university, and we have all those applicants sending us letters where they kind of write, all my life since I was a baby, I wanted to be a doctor. Since I saw the first Barbie doll getting sick, I thought about it. And you can tell that it's sometimes the truth, but most times not. People kind of ended up choosing age 19 that they want to be a doctor. And then they go back in their life and they say, well, how does this event actually lead to this? And how does this lead to that? And they kind of come up with a story that is in their mind too, but it's not how life is. We don't mm-hmm. really have a plan going forward. We kind of stumble upon things and make a story out of that. And that is consciousness's main property, to come up with stories from random things. So for me as well, I think when I was a kid, I thought I wanted to be a magician. And I was practicing magic for years and thought this would be the thing I'm going to do. And then at some point, computers emerged. I was maybe 10 when the first personal computer came. And I got one and I started to play with it. And I think I had a game that I couldn't pass level 2, some kind of Mario version 0.000. And I said, okay, there must be a way. And I tinkered with it and I found a way to hack into Mario and get myself more lives that would allow me to advance. And then turned out that the same hacking technique that I used for Mario applied also for large nation states. So I was recruited 5 years later, something like that, to be a hacker for companies. And then the Israeli intelligence heard about me and kind of said, you should be part of the intelligence. And I got there and then felt that this commodity, the ability to hack, is maybe useful also as a civilian. So started a company that was hacking into banks as a way to help them secure themselves better from hackers. And right about that time, internet became a thing. So suddenly banks actually cared about hacking because they thought everyone can actually come to us from the internet. And somehow this led to me studying philosophy because I wanted to work and study at the same time. Philosophy allowed you to do that and ask the right questions in my mind that led me to realize that only neuroscience is the correct place to answer those. So I went to neuroscience, and I can tell you a story that suggests that everything was planned, but it was really, I can tell you a clear story that hijacking a time that my mom keeps telling about me, which is I enrolled in undergrad university because I was in the military base where I was a soldier in Israel at the time. And I took a hitchhike. I was basically getting a ride from the base to my home. And the guy said, I can't drop you at home. I can only drop you like maybe 2 miles from your place, but that's the only ride I could get. And the 2 miles difference was the university. So he dropped me at the university's other side and I had to cross the university in kind of on my way to home. And I went to the university and I saw it and I said, that's cool. And I signed up to an undergrad. That's how I ended up like, so a ride that was, that's how I got into undergrad. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's nice buildings. I think I could see myself here. Oh gosh. I love that. I love that. I hope my mom, I know my mom is listening. So, you know, kindred spirits. So human consciousness is a really hot topic these days. What is your personal definition of consciousness? You know, what happens to our consciousness when we are asleep, which we call unconscious? What's going on there? That's kind of a two-parter, but what's your definition? What happens when we sleep to that consciousness?
That's a good one. I'll answer your two-parter in three parts. So first I'll say the following. I say, I'm going to give a definition of consciousness in a second. But know that oftentimes in the lab, when we talk about consciousness, we try not to define it. Because every time we define it, we kind of collapse the exploration to only the things we defined, and we miss some things. And the way we think about it is it's something that everyone understands, but if you try to define it, you might miss the essence. We say sometimes jokingly, it's kind of like porn. You know it when you see it.
Of course, I turned beet red when Dr. Cerf said this, but I actually looked it up. In 1964, there was a Supreme Court case, Jacobellis versus Ohio, about whether or not a film shown in a theater was considered porn. And Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart said, I know it when I see it. But back to consciousness.
So basically, there's the experiences, the mechanical part, and there's the quality of them, the actual phenomenological experience in your brain of the things you went. So there's the needle poking into your skin, that's the action, and there's the feeling of pain, and that's the consciousness. And then we also use a different definition that ties to different research, which is the mechanics in the brain that weaves a bunch of memories into a coherent story. So what we say is all the brain has a catalog of a lot of things that happened. Then at some point, someone asks you, Mimi, who are you? And then there's a mechanism in your brain that kind of takes all the narratives, weaves them into a coherent story and calls this me. And this is consciousness. It's a mechanism to just weave events into a coherent story. What happens to it when you sleep? That's what you asked me. So we definitely know that a lot of systems in the brain shut down when you go to sleep. Among them is the system that actually takes memories and tries to make them into a coherent narrative. That is why dreams sometimes feel like they're all over the place, like you suddenly riding a camel and then you're climbing the Eiffel Tower and then it's no longer you. You're looking at yourself from the outside. So we kind of miss the component and all the memories are there. They're just kind of mixed in a salad of like ideas without any kind of thread. And this aligns with our theory of what consciousness is about. It essentially is not active when you're sleeping, but still active enough to keep the flow of time. So there's a difference between being on anesthesia. This I'm jumping on tangent, but it will be relevant in a second.
Ooh, okay, good.
There is a difference between sleeping and anesthesia. People that go to general anesthesia report many times that the arrow of time is distorted. What it means is that if you kind of are put to sleep at noon, the surgery takes 6 hours, and then you wake up in the afternoon, it feels to you like it's been a minute. Like you say, I just close my eyes and open it. Like you somehow don't feel that it's been 6 hours because the anesthesia is putting to sleep even the thing that kind of keeps track of time. Whereas in sleep, we do feel time. So when you go to sleep at night and you wake up in the morning, it feels to you like time's passed. Like you don't say, okay, like I just close my eyes and it's opened again. Like you somehow know that 7 hours passed. So even though in both cases, consciousness is shut down, there are some subsystems that are still active in one versus the other that allow us to somehow maintain the coherence of our life.
As someone who has been under general anesthesia for brain surgery, I can definitely attest to time not existing. It really did feel like one moment I was falling asleep, and the next a giant yellow tube was being pulled out of my throat. I asked the nurse if I died. She said no. I was very much alive. I've always been really intrigued in the brains of children as they develop. Do we have any research going out right now about kids and when they start to remember having dreams?
So I'm sure it's going to come up later. So I'm going to kind of put a pointer right now and we'll get back to it if we talk deeper about dreams. There's no evidence that they actually exist even. We have theories about what they are, but they're is one that says that they really are very different in what happens when we sleep compared to what we speak out when we wake up. So kids are the ultimate machine for manufacturing stories when they wake up. And that is why their dreams are always colorful, fascinating, and rich. But we have no evidence that they actually experience the thing that they tell us when they wake up. They just come up and they have one thought in their mind and they immediately come up with a story around that thought. And maybe this was also what their mind was playing to them when they were sleeping, but maybe not. And it's hard to tell. What we do know about kids and is that presumably if you look at dreams as a mechanical thing that happens only during a stage of sleep called REM, rapid eye movement, kids, babies have a lot more hours of REM. So it's very likely that if dreams are somehow attached to REM, we know that they're not fully, but to an extent they are. Many more dreams happen during REM. Then kids presumably have a lot more dreams. And if that's the case, babies, I would say, even not just kids. And if that's the case, then dreams are also our brain's way of kind of organizing itself. It gives us a lot of time to set memories straight. And we know that kids, and we can only ask them when they start speaking, are only reporting dreams using the language that they have access to. So whereas you can dream things that you have not experienced or that you have no understanding of, you can see kind of, you know, events that you haven't really been through. Kids only dreams things that they have a name for. Like they've seen a unicorn, unicorn goes in the dream. Before they've seen a unicorn, they can't conjure this thing. So their brain is very open to a lot of like stories, but not to inventing new ideas in their dreams.
Okay, so dreams might not even be a thing. And if that's true, we're all lying about them, especially babies. But if they are real, what happens when we get older?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we don't have anything that, you know, can stop us from aging quite yet, unless you have, you know, things you want to tell me later. But our brains are changing constantly as we age, and that includes our memory. So, you know, there's research that as we get older, we become less likely to recall our dreams. Is this like a use it or lose it type thing? Can we keep this demise from happening by training a certain part of our brain? And also, why do some people remember their dreams and other people don't?
So first, I'll say one thing that's not related to my work in any way, but should be in your audience's mind, because it's creepy, interesting, and potentially will change our perspective of aging. There are a few studies right now, they're really recent, that suggest that there are ways to kind of walk back aging. The most extreme version of that is a study on mice, where they essentially take a few week old mouse, that's kind of how old they live, and a very young baby mouse, and they circulate the bloodstream of the two. So blood from the young goes to the old and vice versa, and basically they become one entity that has their bloodstream circulated. And what you see within hours is that the older mouse starts exhibiting signs of getting younger, and the young one becomes older, and they meet in the middle. So something about the nutrients that kind of flow between them actually change their, it's kind of the rejuvenation hormone, it makes them calibrate. And this was now replicated a few times with different kind of ages and different types, suggesting that it works almost kind of independent of how you begin. And this can open up really a Pandora box of, you know, babies for a... Just you produce a baby that all its purpose in life is to circulate blood to you, so you get younger and it gets older, and then you dispose of that baby, and it's all about kind of keeping people young. I can imagine that in like a creepy movie happening, mm-hmm. where you just say, okay, this baby is not for real life, it's just for purposes of making me younger, and you start doing that. So that's on aging generally. To make a more kind of alignment between my work and this, we're looking right now at the aging brain, and particularly at the question, what happens to the brain after you die? So the assumption of kind of the arrow of time and age is that there's a finite end to it, which is you start your life as a baby, you get older, you die at some point, and that's the end of everything, excluding all the questions about afterlife and you know, like reincarnation.
A whole other podcast.
So if we kind of take this life the way we can understand it so far with science, that's the end. It turns out that it's not. There are kind of few recent works that show that you can actually extract the brain of a dead animal, so far it's only with animals, and put this brain in an aquarium and basically create a dialysis machine that feeds the brain with the right nutrients and the right hormones and keep it processing in an aquarium for at least a few hours after the person died. So it becomes now an engineering problem asking how long can you do that. But this means that death is not the final frontier. You can still keep doing things with the brain of a person who died after they died. So this really changes the concept of aging, because we think of aging only as like from young to old. But if you can get old, die, and then stay stable forever, then it's kind of unclear what aging means. You're getting older, but you're no longer having the body that carries that. So we really open up can of worms in even thinking about it kind of as arrow of time simply defining life and death.
I think at this point in the interview, my brain literally walked out of the room for a breather. We're talking about using baby blood to Benjamin Button ourselves and putting our brains in jars after we die to live forever.
I mean, I need a minute to process all this. But Moran forges ahead with more life-shattering information.
That's not what you asked for. That was like my going on a tangent. You asked about kind of normal life, normal aging brain. So what we know is that the brain becomes more rigid as we get older and less likely to change. It still changes. There's still new neurons kind of emerging throughout life, but a lot less of them. And that's a feature of nature. Essentially, nature created humans such that we're born unprepared. You know, if you see a zebra being born, it's born and 5 minutes later, it's already walking and moving because its brain is already kind of fully baked. And babies are not that. When babies are born, it takes them a year to move, speak, see correctly, and interact. Our brain takes longer, but it keeps developing even after this 1 year for decades. So we can spend, some people say up to age 21, some people say up to age 12 or 17. There's like a different kind of numbers based on what is the level of plasticity that you agree upon, but we keep changing. And first it changes a lot. It's kind of oscillating all over the place and it's starting to change less and less and less. And at some point, let's say no matter which scientist you ask, age 25 is where it pretty much stops. And from then on, it's changing still, but very, very little. Some things about you will not change again. Your personality was defined. Your level of openness to new ideas is defined. Some of your characteristics, thinking-wise, are defined. And from that moment on, your brain is all about the opposite. It's about kind of stabilizing things and kind of making sure that everything that is there is correct and precise and not changing. And this is not a bad thing. It's seen as, okay, like a bad thing because I can't change. But I think that nature kind of timed our life properly by saying, you don't want to lose everything all the time. It would be too much if at age 90, you'll start having a new personality. You want to kind of have a period of your life where your brain is adaptive. And at some point, let the brain fixate and keep it the way it is. And I think that even though it's true that we don't change much and we have less plasticity, and if something bad happens to us at age 80, it will be harder to recover than it would be at age 2. I think that's kind of part of the system and part of the good thing about the system. So the bad thing is that if you have a stroke at age 2, you probably will recover within a few months and everything will be okay. If you have a stroke at age 80, you will lose some functions. That's a negative. But also at age 60, you can actually have reflections that you cannot have at age 12. Because not just time, but also you had enough rigid experiences that stayed with you for a while.
I, for one, think 22 was the perfect age for me to have a stroke. My brain was still plastic enough to bounce back, and I was old enough to have some of those life experiences to at least attempt to make some sense of it all. I'm 28 now, so I guess this is as good as it's going to get. Right, Dr. C?
I should say that many people complain to me about their memory failing, and oftentimes, when we actually test them in the lab and we even interact with them, basic kind of interactions without all the equipment on their head, it seems that the memory is perfect. What is declining is not the memory, but is attention. So if you go to a party and someone shakes your hand and says, hi, my name is Jonathan, then you shake their hand and you move away and someone asks, hey, what's this guy's name? 5 seconds later, say, I have no idea. It's not that your memory cannot return the syllables Jonathan for 10 seconds. It's that you never actually registered that. And more what happens is that we become less and less attention grabbing and using it in a flawed way. So we don't even register the memory. If you were using memory properly, you would remember a lot more than you would. It's just that there's a lot of things and we choose to not remember to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. I'm that person. I'm like, what? 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 So 2010 was a huge year for you, Moran. You put out a study called Studying Consciousness Using Direct Recording from Single Neurons in the Human Brain. I feel like we could do a whole separate podcast just about this study and the events that followed. But first, what were you looking to discover in this particular study?
So I'm trying to be playful and kind of use the most non-jargon language in transition. So I'll do my best to maintain it in the next 2 minutes. I think that what I'm known for as a neuroscientist is a work that commented in this 2010 paper and a number of others around this time. And the method is what's kind of unique. And that is we study the brains of people while they're on the operating room, and essentially their skull is open, their brain is exposed. We stick electrodes inside their head, deep, record activity of single neurons in their head connected to a machine, and essentially we can see their thoughts, memories, decisions, emotions in real time. That's the method. So the method is open a person's brain, put electrodes inside, connect them to a machine, and start recording brain activity. I should clarify that this is not something that we do to volunteers from the street. We do it in the context of clinical research. Those are patients that have some kind of brain disorder that requires brain surgery clinically. So they have epilepsy. And the point of the surgery is to figure out where is the onset, where is the focus of the epilepsy that we can actually fix. In order to do that, we open their brain, stick the electrodes inside, and keep them in hospital for a few weeks while we wait for them to have a seizure so that we can actually triangulate the location of the seizure and take it out and fix the problem. And in the course of those weeks of waiting for seizures to occur, it will tell us what's the problem. We can also do science. So we can also tell the person, you're going to be here for the next 2 weeks with electrodes in your brain. Between seizures, do you mind also talking to me about your feelings and allowing me to understand how emotions work in the brain?
Okay, so this is really cool. And I honestly wish Moran had put some electrodes in my brain while I was under the knife. But how does this work exactly? How does the implant in the person's brain decode their thoughts? Moran breaks it down for me using my podcast equipment as an example.
There is, in your brain story, there is a cell that codes the concept of a microphone. You have a microphone in front of you. You know what microphones are. You had to use one for this podcast. So your brain at some point learned what microphones are and created a brain cell, a cluster of them actually, that code the concept. So every time you see a microphone, those cells light up, telling the other parts of the brain, we're seeing a microphone. So if I could put electrodes next to those cells and figure out that I'm now looking at microphone cells, I know exactly what you're thinking when those cells light up. If they light up, you're seeing a microphone or you're thinking about a microphone. So if I map a few of those with the patients, I can actually tell the patient, now I'm going to sit there quietly and you just close your eyes and imagine things, and I can project on the screen what you're thinking. So I will see which neurons light up and I will just show a movie of the patient's thoughts. And essentially that's the kind of baseline of what we did back there. We showed people's thoughts on a screen, and what we did that was kind of scientifically interesting, we also looked at how many of those neurons code one thought. What happens if I show you on the screen one thing, but ask you to imagine something else? So I'll show you a picture of Marilyn Monroe.
If you didn't catch that, we're looking at a picture of Marilyn Monroe now. You know, bombshell blonde, skirt in the wind.
So your eyes see Marilyn Monroe, but I tell you to make it such that you won't see her. Like, make other neurons in your brain light up. So you kind of, somehow in your mind's eye, you see something else. Can I do that? Can I actually change your thoughts by zapping those neurons? We ask a lot of questions. These studies in 2010 were the output of those 5 years of work that show that you can actually decode thoughts, project them, and interpret them as if I'm having you tell me what you're thinking, just without you speaking. I'm just talking to your brain directly.
Mm-hmm. So that was what the study was. And then some crazy stuff happened. And I'm going to let you kind of also tell me about those things within the context of the same year this movie called Inception came out, which was a coincidence for you. And you'll tell me why. But as of today, I want to know, what is real about dream research and what is science fiction?
Okay, so much. So I feel like I really need to think of an angle that tells us. Okay, so what you're alluding to is the study came out in October 28, I believe. The study that shows you can project thoughts. It was remarkable in many ways. We could look at your brain's activity and project your thoughts. The one thing it didn't have is anything to do with dreams.
Okay, so the single neuron study had nothing to do with dreams. This is going to get crazy in a second.
So all the subjects in our study were people who were awake. They were thinking about things. They were looking at movies and so on. And we could read their mind and show it on the screen. Pretty remarkable, but they were all awake.
So Moran and his team published this story that has, again, nothing to do with dreams. And the phone rings.
I got a call from a reporter who basically asked me a question about whether the same idea that we did, which is projecting a thought on a screen, could be done when you're sleeping, and if you can project someone's dreams. So can you essentially have the same patients go to sleep, they start dreaming, and I can decode their dreams and show it on a screen? And this is not what we did. And this was not done by anyone. And I said, no, it's not possible. It's not what we did, at least. And the guy said, but is it kind of potentially something that we could do? And the wording here was important, but I basically ended up saying something like, in theory, it's possible. And then the phone was hung. And the next thing that you see on the headline of, I think BBC was the first one, was the scientists say that gene encoding is possible, and possible was still in kind of quotes. And quickly after it escalated, it became the dominant story in the news for 10 days. From possible, it was done by the CIA in collaboration with the scientist, done for a while. A chip inside the brain can tell us what you're thinking. And it quickly moved from a note in a conversation over a phone to a reality that I had to struggle with and explain one time to hundreds of reporters why this is not true.
Okay, so this has spiraled so out of control that within 10 days, Moran Cerf is now the most popular scientist alive, and everyone thinks the CIA has been recording dreams for decades. To make matters more hilarious, Cerf dressed up like Sigmund Freud that year for Halloween, further solidifying his image as the dream recorder. Oh, and Inception had come out that year, so Hollywood director Christopher Nolan just called him up and was like, hey, you want to go on tour with me and talk about all this dream recording you're doing? Crazy.
It escalated beyond proportion, but the point I think that I find relevant as an inspirational idea for a scientist, I spent in the course of those 10 days and even the few months after countless of hours telling reporters that dream recording is impossible. You will find hundreds of quotes of me explaining why this is not what happened and this is impossible. The word didn't get to colleagues of mine in Japan. It was far enough that they didn't hear that it's impossible, and they just read the kind of article that say it's possible and scientists are doing that. So they followed up on my work, on my fake work. And they actually tried to do the same thing that we supposedly did, record dreams, and succeeded. So 3 years after I claimed that it's impossible, the first paper came out from a colleague of mine, Yuki Kamitani in Japan, that shows that you can actually record dreams. So I had to walk back twice. I had to say, I didn't do it as an impossible. Actually, it's possible. And now I'm doing it myself. So 10 years after, it's possible and everyone does it right now.
Wow. Okay. So it is, as of 2020, it is possible to record or extract. I don't know how, you know, obviously I love the movie Inception and they're like stealing things. And, you know, I want to know more, like, what's the line that we're drawing between, like, yes, this part is possible, but this part is like territory for Christopher Nolan.
So there's like two things we're after as scientists when you talk about dreams, and they are related. One is extracting the content. So we want you to have to go sleep. We look at your brain with some device, ideally not an electrode in the brain, but something that is less invasive, and we extract the content. So you wake up, and we can play a movie of your dream. That's the first thing we want to do. The second thing we want to do is actually stimulate. So actually make you have a dream. So you go to sleep, and you say, I don't care what my brain suggests. I want to have a date with who's kind of a good actor, Sean Penn. I want to have
Sean Penn, perfect.
I want to have a date with Sean Penn in my dream. And I want it to be as real as possible because dreams feel real when they happen. So just make it happen. So you go to sleep and you stimulate the right thing and make my brain conjure the movie where I am on a date with Sean Penn. So those are the two things we want, to read the content and to write a new one. The first thing, we're doing much better than the second. And we're still at the level that is neuroscience level, not engineer level. What I mean by that is that we're right now playing with seeing what's the level of resolution that we can get to. Once we get to a high resolution, then engineers would have to perfect the mechanism that kind of does it even more efficiently, that everyone can use it and so on. Where are we right now? Right now, there's two kind of rivaling groups that are working on extracting dreams. I belong to one of them, and the other is the guys in Japan. I'm saying rivaling, but what I mean by this is that we have two approaches. Approach number one is the Japan approach. Now Berkeley has Professor Jack Gallant that's also in the play and a number of others, but kind of I would give the Japan guys the flag on the moon for that. They use fMRI, which is a non-invasive tool. It's a big machine that you put the brain through, and it injects magnetic fields through your head and sees what gets absorbed, and it knows what's going on in your brain in a very low resolution. What these guys are doing is looking at the part of the brain in the back where images, vision emerges, and they basically read the brain like a movie. So when you, the dream. So when you wake up, they say, we've seen a yellow stain at the corner and a blue rectangle at the bottom. And they kind of create a visual of your dream, but it's sometimes very, very low resolution. So it requires interpretation. So you might say, oh, the yellow thing was the sun and the blue thing was the sea. And I was looking at the sea, but it looks like yellow circle, blue rectangle, and it could be tons of things. And they're not really able to be accurate on the story. They are kind of having images that if you know the dream, it's very easy to see why it's that. But without knowing it, there are a lot of ways to interpret it. And it's like very, very low resolution movie. That's approach number one. Approach number two, ours, is looking at a different part of the brain. So we put the electrodes in the brain in the memory area, and we find cells that code concepts, microphone, your mom, your dad, the Eiffel Tower. So strict concept. And then when you go to sleep, we look at those cells fire, and we see that your mom cell light up, and then immediately after your dad cell light up, immediately after the ocean light up. So we can kind of say, okay, this is the set of things that you've seen in your mind. And we can come up with a story for you. It was you and your dad going to the ocean, but we won't see the visual. So ours is limited. We are very, very accurate in the concept that you see, but we have no idea if your mom was wearing a blue shirt or a white shirt and so on. We don't see any visuals. We just see the kind of concept, one after the other. So we can create a narrative from concept. So together, this will be perfect. If I can say your mom in pink triangle, so she's wearing a pink suit, that's going to be kind of the perfect story. Right now, it's nearly impossible to just merge those. That's why I'm saying it's an engineering problem. The way we work requires brain surgery, and it requires a sterile room that cannot be in the fMRI machine, so the two don't work together mechanically. Once we're confident that we have those two methods kind of perfected, I think we will give the entire thing to engineers and tell them, build a machine that allows us to do that together, and then we're going to get the full story. But we're right now in just like kind of the early steps of getting the essence of a dream.
Wow, that is incredible. That is some Inception stuff right there. Can you talk to us about lucid dreaming? How can the brain be aware that we're dreaming? And how come if I wake up, I can't just jump back into the dream and pick back up where I left off?
So lucid dreaming is the idea that you, at some point in your dream, kind of wake up, but you're still dreaming. So you know that you're dreaming. You essentially consciousness-wise wake up and you say, oh, I'm dreaming, but I'm aware of that. So I can navigate the dream to wherever I want. For example, the classical answer to what people do when they dream is they choose to fly. So they open the window in their dream and they step out of the window and they start flying, hovering around New York City, because you can fly now because it's a dream, but you control. And then they summon people that like, I haven't seen my grandmother for years since she died and I want to meet her. And suddenly she emerges and you can have a conversation with her. So it's a way to have a dream where you're the director, not just the actor. That's what it is. Unfortunately, about 12% of the population can have it voluntarily. They can actually get into it if they want, or they can even go to sleep and plan to have it. And the majority of us will either never experience that, or if we experience it, it would be fleeting, so we wouldn't be able to kind of repeat that experience. My colleagues and myself are playing in the last 2 years with all kinds of ways to induce that. There are a few studies, and I'm a little bit careful because we don't know that it kind of generalizes beyond, but we can actually have you go to sleep and stimulate with a specific frequency and a specific time your brain when you're sleeping, and this makes you snap into lucid dreaming. So far, it works perfectly with those 12% of people that know that they can wake up without waking up. And it's questionable if it works on the remaining 80-something percent that have never experienced that. But my intuition is that it will. So my intuition is that lucid dreaming will become a commodity in a kind of very soon in a product. You buy a product, you put it next to your bed, you turn it on, and you say, I want to have a lucid dream. It will monitor your brain activity. It will know when you're getting to REM state, when you're basically starting to dream, and it will then start stimulating your brain, increasing the chance of you having a lucid dream, which means that we can not have, it doesn't mean that we're going to remember the dream. It doesn't mean that we can actually change the dream from the outside, but the dreamer himself or herself would be able to have full control of the dream, which is still pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I'd do a lot of things if I could control my dreams. Speaking of which, I constantly have this reoccurring dream, and it's gum in my mouth. And I'm pulling it, and I'm pulling it, and all of a sudden I have braces, and I haven't had braces since high school. And then I'm, you know, it turns into one of those never-ending magician scarves, and it's very stressful. And it turns out my aunt, who is also a teacher, she has a very similar recurring dream. So my question is, you know, can repeat dreams reveal things about our waking lives or even our futures? That's, I mean, maybe you don't want to comment on that, but...
We have no evidence that dreams can predict the future. So far, we do have evidence to people having getting to the future and saying, oh my God, I had a dream that predicts that. But this could be that you have a dream of like 20 different futures. One of them happens and you say, oh my God, I had a dream about that. So people experience futures as if they dreamt about them. And I'll tell you in a second why this is likely to happen. But very few people can actually wake up and say, tomorrow there's going to be an earthquake, and it does happen. Only when the earthquake happens, they say, I dreamt about it 2 weeks ago. So it's like it's easier to reverse the story from the future, say, I actually thought about this future, but not predict it. To the question about recurring dreams, and particularly the one about the gum and the teeth, turns out that there are classical kind of elements that occur in dreams across ages, across populations, among which is something with teeth falling and having problems with your ability to speak or walk. There are studies that look at dream diaries, people's stories when they wake up. And a few of the kind of clear themes that come up is my teeth are falling, or I have some kind of inability to speak when I need to, or I'm trying to run and I only get to walk in my dreams. People report dreams about being late for exams is a very popular one. Or something happens and you're late for that, or being naked in public. Those are the key theme. There were dreams that were kind of studied in other places that are kind of third world countries that had to do with third world countries' problems at the time, which was being attacked by beasts and having no water and no food. So it really kind of coincides with the biggest fear that civilization is experiencing typically manifest themselves in dreams. There are even anecdotes about that kind of right now. A lot of people are reporting dreams about gadgets, like about the phone being lost and so on. What we take from that is that one of the theories about what dreams are for is that dreams are a way for our brain to rehearse possible futures and prepare for them. So you actually live life right now, but you're worried about whether you're concerned, for instance, between two options. Should you stay in New York and continue your career the way it is? Or should you move to Alabama and start a life there as a farmer with your lover?
Okay, I don't know about you, but I would definitely pick move to Alabama to be a farmer with my lover.
Your dream actually creates a movie with you in Alabama with your lover in the farm. And because dreams are kind of filtered through our senses as if they're real, when we're dreaming, we can't separate that from, it's a virtuality that is the ultimate virtuality because it feels reality as it happens. Your brain actually kind of sees all the options, gets a sense of it. So when you wake up, even if you forget a dream, you still have a better ability to make decisions and whether you want to choose that. So I think that's aligned with this reality. And the fact that it's recurring means it's just not resolved. But now is the time to say the thing that we kind of hinted towards in the beginning. There is no clear evidence that the story you remember is in any way the story that your brain actually had when you dreamt. It's not uncommon for people to actually wake up from something that has nothing to do with the dream that they dreamt and take this thought that they have in their mind at the moment and build an entire narrative that they claim was a dream. I'll give you an example and then I'll stop because I can talk about it forever. And I know that you have so many questions that I'm going to not hijack all the time. There's this classical study. People were sleeping. When they went to the more likely moment where they're dreaming, this REM stage, someone was banging the cymbals next to their ears and quickly hiding them. So the person kind of wakes up from the sound of an explosion. And they say, oh my God, I had this crazy dream. Tell us. Well, I was walking in the street and suddenly I heard this explosion. So I was looking to my right and there was a house that collapsed. So I ran to the house and there was a little baby and I saved the baby and I ran out. And but I remember there's a puppy there. I went and saved the puppy. Basically, people crafted an entire story that begins with the explosion and just makes up an entire narrative that all involves the things that happened afterwards. Presumably, none of those things actually were in the dream. They just heard the sound of an explosion, but the brain didn't like being in this state of unclear kind of story. It's just like an explosion sitting in itself. So it made up an entire story, and all of this story was made up instantly when you woke up, but felt to you like it was in your dreams. So none of that was real, but your brain tells a story. So presumably, when it comes to you, it could be that you're really concerned about something. And every time you wake up, your brain goes back to this thing that you're concerned about, and it feels to you like it was your dream, but actually it wasn't your dream. It was just a story that you're concerned about when you wake up, and you keep thinking about it.
Okay, okay, all right. So here's the real question, though. If that's true, so this weird thing happens to me sometimes. I wake up, and I think I'm still in my dream. And sometimes I'm even talking, or I'm moving around, or for instance, when I was a teacher, I would think I was in my classroom. Mm-hmm. And it would take me a few minutes to actually convince myself that I wasn't. So is my brain stuck in some, you know, dream loop? What's that about?
it's actually more common these days than it used to before, which leads some neuroscientists to suggest it has to do with virtual reality and like we're kind of getting used brain-wise to a blurry line between reality and not reality. So even when we wake up, if we are unclear about what's going on, we essentially choose a story that says, oh, I'm probably just still dreaming. So people actually, and then you fall asleep again. So what you remember is the kind of ambiguity, and you interpret it as like, I guess it was a dream within a dream.
I really didn't think I was as plugged into virtual reality as my dreams within dreams would suggest. Moran says our concept of what's real and what's not is getting blurrier by the day. But maybe that's not a bad thing. Because of this, we can actually alter dreams.
We try all kinds of things that would affect your dream without waking you up, including spraying the right smells into your nose, playing the right sounds, touching you. Turns out the touch is one of those things that has a strong effect. So if you touch people, for instance, in certain part in their leg, that kind of creates a knee-jerk kind of reaction that they kind of feel like they're falling. Whatever they're dreaming about would involve like them kind of falling for a second. So you can actually activate a story about a person falling by just touching their feet. If you pour water on people when they're sleeping in the dream stage, they're very likely to actually dream about water, waterfalls, the ocean, or something like this. Presumably, it's a mechanism for our brain to actually wake us up when we need to pee. That's sufficient. But all of those stories lead us to also see that people that have this interaction, so someone actually interfaces with their dream, someone actually interferes with their dream and makes them dream, typically they kind of jump between regular dream to partial awakeness and back to dream. And when they wake up afterwards, they tell you, I had a dream within a dream. So it seems that the interaction somewhat wake you up, but your brain tries to keep you asleep. So you jump back to dream without actually waking up, but you code that in your experiences as there was a gap in my dream. I must have woken up, jumped from place to place, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So onto the scary stuff, nightmares. It's 2020, so it's kind of hard enough being awake these days. But is there a benefit to studying the nightmare piece? And could you maybe, like you were saying, with manipulating some of that, could you help people process maybe their real life traumas while they're sleeping, maybe making them face those fears face to face? And is that legal? I don't even know if that's something you're allowed to do.
So we're talking about a lot in the small community of people who look at dreams right now, because here's what we can do. We can actually minimize your trauma during nightmares. So we can make it disappear. We can spray the right smell in the right time and take a bad dream and make it pleasant and at least kind of change that. We can actually code that you're going through a bad dream and wake you up. So we can do a lot of things that will stop bad dreams from happening. There's a difference between night terrors and nightmares. That's like very nuancey, like when they happen and how often they happen and so on. But for the sake of discussion, let's focus on nightmares, which are kind of movies that are bad that you see when you're dreaming towards the end of the night. We can stop them. And the big question is, should we? So if you buy into the theory that dreams have a purpose, for example, that's your brain's way of simulating futures and rehearsing for them, that the nightmares are actually there for a purpose. The fact that you're attacked by a bear allows you to kind of study, okay, I should actually go from the left and do this and do that. And when it actually happens in real life, you're prepared because you rehearsed it multiple times. So if we stop that, you actually didn't rehearse. So the question that we ask is, should we?
This is a really tricky question. So far, where Moran and his team draw the line is interfering with people who have nightmares that follow them into their waking lives, like people with post-traumatic stress disorder.
They're reliving this scenario that got them into the trauma in the first place again and again with ways that are critical and potentially affect their quality of life. And then in the dream, same thing happens. And because it's in the past, they already went through the experience. This is just purely terror. There's no use for that. Like, you already had the bad experience, just reliving it. So then we definitely stop them. But it's a big question right now in the world of trauma, asking, is your brain a mechanism that's supposed to take care of itself, or should I intervene? And it's true for a lot of memories, and nightmares are an example of that. And I don't have a good answer, other than it's something that we're thinking about right now.
Yeah. So a lot of the work that you're doing, I have two more questions and then a kind of a fun bonus question. A lot of the work that you're doing right now is in science communication. And I watched your TED called Can You Trust Your Brain, which blew my brain. You are a three-time Grand Slam moth champion. You talked about robbing banks and missing flights on stages. It's hilarious and amazing. What do you think is the most essential story about science to be communicating to people right now?
Can I give you two?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that there's one that is kind of interesting scientifically, and one that I think everyone should think about as citizens. Scientifically, I think we're entering a new era where we're beginning to understand that the senses that we're born with are an option. They're not what we have to keep. So we live in a world where we have eyes, nose, ears, mouth, and that's how we basically sample the world outside. But we realize that the world outside is much richer than what we can grasp with the senses. So our eyes can only see between the ultraviolet to infrared spectrum. So we don't see radio waves. We don't see X-ray. They're there, but we can't see them. And it's because our eyes don't have the right kind of sampling sequence that can capture them. But our brain can process them. So if we could build an eye that will sample parts of the world that is not what the eye currently captures, we will see X-ray, like Superman. So we are beginning to realize that senses, the way we're kind of born, are just an option, and we can build better ones, different ones, and see more of the world. This opens up a world of opportunities where you can restore senses that were lost. So a person that was born blind could get sight back. A person that was born deaf could learn to hear. A person that lost an arm in an accident could regain a prosthetic one, but it would feel like it's his because we just connect them to the brain, and the senses that were there will just work again. But also you can say, well, if I can attach a new arm and connect it to your brain, why don't we attach four arms? So we'll have like, you know, seven of them. It's still science fiction-ish. So people kind of are saying, oh, but it's not there yet, so never mind. And I think this is something that is interesting, inspiring, and soon enough that it should be discussed right now. And this takes me to the other one that I think, so this one is for geeks, the first one. Everyone who's geeking on their brain should kind of read more about that. The second one is for everyone. And I think that's the ethics of that. I think that we're entering an era where your brain becomes a commodity. It's vulnerable. Someone can plant ideas in your brain. You can manipulate people's thoughts when they're sleeping. You can change memories. You can govern attention. You can do things that take away the agency that people have on their brain. We have this kind of logo in the lab that says, don't believe everything you think, because it kind of gets to a world where this is the reality, that your thoughts could be planted by someone else. And to me, we're just entering this era. It's not really there, it's not fully there, but it's enough there that I'm concerned about it. I think everyone who listens to your podcast should start thinking about that, forming an opinion, and I would say, start asking questions of whoever they see as authority. From scientists, what they're doing about that, from congressmen and women, what they think about regulating it, from senators, from president. I think it should be something that people should start asking. And if people start asking, then the people who are deciding would have to come up with answers. And before long, it would be a topic of debates. I bet there are going to be a lot of debates in the coming weeks between politicians. And we need to guarantee that no one's going to ask either Donald Trump or Joe Biden what's their stance on neural implants. It's won't come up. And I think they should be, because people are working on it. And when neural implants are there, it's going to be too late. Then you can actually manipulate people's thoughts easily. And you know, it will be kind of, did someone else get into my mind? Is it okay? Like, did my vote come up from my brain or not? So for every person, I think that the one thing that I wish kind of this would lead to is that they say, oh, I heard about something that I think I'm concerned about. I want to talk about it more, ask questions about it more, make it a topic that people talk about. That's for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what an important time to be thinking about our thoughts. Very meta. I have a fun question for you before the final one. What's a fun or crazy dream that you've had recently that you can remember if you can?
I had a really funny one. I immediately shared it because I felt like I needed. So I had a dream where it's the strangest thing. I tried to see if someone else had that because I really felt it was a joke. I had a dream where in my dream, there was a kind of a regular dream movie I'm talking about, but there was on in a corner, an interpreter for the deaf. So someone was there, like in sign language, interpreting my dream. I said, like, this is ridiculous. I can hear. And the only person getting to see this dream is me. Why is my brain creating an interpreter that's just like an extra person, but putting it in my entire dream is like for another audience that's not me? I thought it's weird. I found it amusing. I immediately wrote about it because I said it's like such a funny thing for my brain to kind of create. And I could not find any example of that from any literature of someone else reporting similar thing. That was funny.
I think it's Leo DiCaprio, and maybe he's deaf in this particular film, so he needs ASL, you know, like me. That's so interesting. So I'm not going to ask you where the future of science is going, because we know how well that worked out in 2010. But I want to know what you're working on next. You know, are you writing any books, any new projects, consulting directors on any sci-fi films right now?
So here's my take on the 2010 versus 2020. What I learned, and this is like a motto now of a lot of my thinking about science and kind of film, is that the difference between science fiction and science is timing. You wait long enough, every episode of Star Trek becomes reality. Every weapon that you see in Star Wars is offered in some eBay store. So I think that I'm now very, very unlikely to say something is impossible to an interviewer ever. I think that I spend some time talking to Hollywood still on ways to take the recent work and put them in shows. I still believe that Hollywood has a much better reach than I do. So my papers get read by 10 people.
Me, I'm one of them.
11. But you have something that you can do about it. So my other 10 colleagues, they're kind of talking to each other and that's it. But this podcast will probably be seen, heard, and communicated to 3 times more people than I ever had access to as a scientist. So I'm doing my best to kind of talk about that. The work I'm doing right now looks at a question that is, to me, interesting, but I still didn't find the framing of like why everyone should care about it like right away, which is, can we detect your personality psychologically traits from your brain? So the idea is that there is something that is to be mimi. You're an introvert. You're neurotic. I'm making it up. I don't know if it's true. You're very agreeable. So there are some kind of traits that psychologists would use to characterize you. And the question I ask is, can I look at you while you have your brain scanned and not ask you a single question? So you just sit there and I'm scanning your brain. And 10 minutes later, I'm kind of creating a scorecard that says Mimi is A, B, C, D. So essentially figure out what you are personality-wise by looking at your brain. Presumably it's coded there somewhere. The question is, can we read it? And if that's the case, then we can also change it, and we can also help your therapist get kind of a better understanding of who you are and how you change. There's a lot of things we can do. But step one is just to see if we can detect your psychology from your brain without talking to you.
Wow. Mind blown. Thank you again for being on the podcast, and we're looking forward to seeing all the things that you have going next.
Today's episode of Mimi and the Brain was produced and written by yours truly, with sound mixing by Ryan Ergo, music by Lucas Murray Music, artwork by Joya Spangler, and equipment by Gotham Sound. You're going to find some amazing extras about Dr. Moran's surf in the show notes, so be sure to go check those out. And feel free to rate and review on your favorite podcasting site. Catch you, Gooey Brains, later.
Should we do the end now? Yeah, it's my personal best. Can't do any better than that.